welcome to a special emergency episode of Conduct Detrimental. I'm joined this week by the one, the only, Dan Wallach.
Dan, nice to talk to you and see you again on Zoom. All the episodes are special, but not all of them are emergencies. I would say a Supreme Court decision in the realm of sports law every 3 years qualifies as an emergency edition of Conduct Detrimental. And we did one for the Christie decision back when I was co-hosting with Dan Worley. And now we're going to do an emergency special podcast, bringing on our guest, Mark Edelman. The ink is barely dry on the Supreme Court decision. And I think this is one of the most momentous decisions that has occurred in sports law since I've been around. It's going to change the face of how the NCAA treats its athletes. It's going to change a lot about college athletics. So it's really exciting to be able to get into it right away, hot off the presses with Mark.
Legitimately hot off the presses. Last time we did an emergency episode was the Super League Symposium, which was another form of an emergency. But yeah, this is a decision that comes at a really interesting time for college sports. July 1st, people have circled on the calendar for months now, and that's when the first states in our country will allow athletes to be legally paid for endorsements. Now, this decision comes just 10 days prior to that July 1st date, June 21st. So we have the judicial branch kind of closing in on the NCAA with this decision, a unanimous 9-0 decision. And we have the legislative branch in the state and federal level also closing in on the NCAA. So you really have it both sides. It's like that scene, Dan, in Star Wars where like the garbage compactor is closing in on both sides. And what's the NCAA going to do?
Lesson here is be careful what you wish for. Was it the NCAA that filed the petition for writ of certiorari with the Supreme Court? I mean, they kind of brought this on themselves with their tactical decision to seek Supreme Court review. And now their entire system of overseeing collegiate athletics is now going to be dramatically changed. So I'm really excited about today's episode. It's good. It's good to get down to, you know, almost being back on U.S. soil. This brings me a little bit closer. I don't know if you're aware of this. I might have mentioned it once or twice, but I'm in Novosibirsk, Siberia for the past 6 months. I know it's comes as a major shock to anyone who listens to the podcast, but I'm down to the final 3 days. I'm officially going to be back in the United States late Thursday night, early Friday morning. So hopefully you and I will be simpatico on the same, you know, in real time, same time zone, and we'll be able to more consistently deliver some of these late breaking stories. Luckily I was still up. It's almost midnight in Siberia as we're recording this. So really excited about coming home and excited about today's podcast.
Sports Law doesn't take a holiday. Sports Law doesn't have any jurisdictions. We cover it whenever and wherever it breaks. To set up our guest, this last line, Dan, you said something really interesting. You said that maybe the NCAA made a mistake by taking this to the highest court of land and issuing that suggestion that maybe the Supreme Court should weigh in. The last line of Justice Kavanaugh's concurring opinion said the NCAA is not above the law. So we're going to have our guest, Mark Edelman, professor at Fordham and Baruch College, my old sports law professor once upon a time at Fordham. He's going to speak to whether that this decision and whether the goal was to close this potential antitrust loophole or this potential opening for the NCAA to continue to argue, hey, Justice Stevens' opinion back in Board of Regents back in 1984, this allows the NCAA to do whatever they want with carte blanche because they're going to have this antitrust exemption at some point in time. So that was how we kind of phrased it to Professor Edelman. But just a quick background on Mark. I know you and I have both known him for a decade. Maybe you've known him a little bit longer. He is maybe, I want to say, the most published individual in the sports law space from a law review perspective. I call him Professor Adam. I'm sure you maybe call him Mark. But I've seen pictures where he has all of his law review clippings all scattered around his walls. I think some people would love to have one law review article. He's probably has too many to count at this point. So he's really the foremost expert on really law review scholarly articles. And as we'll get into, he's written on this topic before. And Dan, Justice Kavanaugh's decision very closely resembles the structure and format that he has written on.
And now grueling the process is to write any article. But when you take a law review article, which is an exposition on a topic with the footnotes alone, I mean, it takes a long time to round a law review article into shape. I'm in the midst of finishing one myself, and it is a little bit of an eye-opener in terms of the depth of not so much analysis, but no footnote goes unpunished, basically. You footnote something, and then that becomes a mini exposition on the topic. So it's an interesting process, and to write as many as he's written or Michael McCann has written, that takes a lot of work and a lot of heavy lifting and a lot of late nights on Westlaw, Lexis, and on the internet, you know, just shaping up your research. It's really a lot of work that goes into publishing a single law review article.
I guess it goes without saying, Professor Edelman, Michael McCann, two of the bigger experts on this topic. Obviously, Michael McCann was speaking at the Senate hearings about 10 days ago. So the Sports Law Universe, both friends of the show, have been covering this. I guess it goes without saying, Mark Edelman is one of the foremost experts in this field, and it's our pleasure to have him coming in on very short notice, and all this stuff is right off the top of the noggin. He is an absolute expert in the weeds with all this stuff. And with that said, let us turn it over to Mark Edelman. June 21st, 2021, a historic day in sports law, and to break it down, I have the one, the only, Professor Mark Edelman. How's it going, Professor Edelman?
It's going well. It's good to be here, Dan.
I know we were kind of circling June as the date we'd get a decision. I know someone thought it would come last week, but nevertheless, we have it today. So a 9-0 unanimous verdict. And the reason I wanted to have you on, and you in particular, obviously I gave you your shout outs on social media, but you were the only one, as far as I am aware today or whatever, that has predicted had predicted a 9-0 unanimous verdict. So I guess let's start there. Tell us your initial thoughts on the decision and, you know, how that kind of matches up to your 9-0 prediction back in March.
Well, thank you. Well, first, obviously, I'm not surprised. I had been predicting this would have gone 9-0 for a long time, and it did. I thought the biggest question was not who was going to win, but whether certain justices would issue a ruling with dicta that was even more favorable to the college athletes than the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, and Kavanaugh again did. At the same time, as convinced as I was of the ruling, and as long as I've written that this would be a 9-0 ruling, there's still a sense of gratification and relief when you ultimately see that decision in writing, not only because it means making a prediction right and meaning that everything I've studied and written on for all these years has been on point, but far more importantly for the college athletes, this is going to be a big step, not only towards allowing them to get certain in-kind educational benefits, but really opening up the door for far greater reform to the NCAA than that association would have ever done voluntarily.
It comes at an interesting time, and this is why the decision, you know, the anticipated decision of June was always going to be, I don't know, an interesting decision tree, right? Because at the same time this decision comes out, the legislative walls are kind of coming in on the NCAA, and they're making these decisions, you know, hey, we maybe as the NCAA should make rules, maybe schools should make NIL rules. Now you have this decision. So I want to kind of unpack where this falls in the decision tree or which kind of gun is being pointed at the NCAA. Can you kind of explain and unpack how this decision will impact name, image, likeness, if at all?
Well, this decision at the same time both means everything and means nothing at all for name, image, and likeness. To say it means nothing at all, this was not a case about the NCAA's restraints in terms of third-party name, image, and likeness. This was a case that at least 8 of the judges, leave aside the Kavanaugh concurrence, limited their review to a very narrow set of facts, which was the agreement amongst NCAA member schools to disallow direct provisions of educational related benefits. So the two topics are separated from one another. This decision did not say anything whatsoever per se about NIL. On the other hand, very clearly in Kavanaugh's concurrence, but even within Gorsuch's majority opinion, the language of this decision made undoubtedly clear that the NCAA's rules with respect to college athlete compensation are subject to an antitrust review and are not per se legal or legal just at a twinkling of the eye. This seems to make very clear that if the NCAA were to attempt to sanction a college that were to comply with their state's rules and allow athletes to sign NIL deals, that conduct would be almost certainly seen as a violation of antitrust law, which puts the NCAA's back very much against the wall. Even though this case did not per se say the words NIL, if the NCAA were to try to stop a college from participating, because their athletes sign nil deals, the analysis of this case would be very much the same. Now, the Congress is currently looking at federal nil legislation, and maybe it will happen before July 1st when bills go into place. Maybe it will not take place before July 1st. But either way, there is very little that the NCAA member schools at this present moment can do to try to refrain their athletes from signing third-party endorsements. And once this begins, the cat is out of the bag. Once we have a year with college athletes signing endorsement deals, where the fans recognize it does not hurt the game and the athletes make some money from doing so, to try to unwind it would be a near impossibility.
I just had a little bit of a flashback moment. And for those listeners of the podcast, obviously, Professor Edelman was my sports law professor way back when at Fordham Law School. I remember sitting in your classroom. It was the summer, I think, of 2011, right around there.
That's correct.
I think it was. Or I think it was right, give or take. We'll say plus or minus a year and a half. But I bring it up. I remember sitting in your classroom and you were talking about the Board of Regents decision back in 1983. And there had been a lot of analysis of that opinion, even in the days and weeks leading up to this Supreme Court decision, NCAA versus Alston. And in particular, the line that got a lot of attention was Justice Stevens' line, where he, you know, people have viewed him to kind of say that the NCAA maybe would get an antitrust exemption at some point in time. And this might be an obvious question, but how do you think this decision in the language, you know, that Judge Kavanaugh used and Judge Gorsuch, how do you think that impacts the antitrust analysis moving forward?
Well, my reading of Board of Regents, the 1984 case decided by Judge Stevens, did not talk about a future antitrust exemption. It was rather limiting language of the scope of that decision. Board of Regents, despite whatever the NCAA says, was not a win for the NCAA. It was a big, colossal loss. This was the case that found that the NCAA member schools violated antitrust law when they came together to limit the number of games that individual schools could play on television. Now, there are two pieces in dicta. And for those who are not familiar, dicta is not holding of the case. It's not binding. It's just other things that the judges say in the course of the opinion, that the NCAA has cobbled together for nearly the past 25 years and has used to pretend that somehow it created an amateurism exemption. One of them said that the NCAA's rules are not per se illegal, but have to be carefully scrutinized under the rule of reason because of certain benefits that might be involved in terms of having amateur athletes, which was not a statement of legality, but a statement of the mode of analysis that the NCAA misused and bastardized into a totally different purpose. The other language was the last paragraph of Judge Stevens's opinion, which some people who are less learned on antitrust law and a lot of reporters had always taken to say that the NCAA's no pay rules are okay. Now, the reason why a case like Alston I was able to predict, and to me it's not reading tea leaves, is if you really know your antitrust law, there are certain patterns of things that you see from opinion to opinion. And the reality is just about every Supreme Court antitrust case that Justice Stevens decided ended the same way. And that was with two paragraphs at the end of the opinion that are intended to make clear that the decision of the opinion was only based on those facts and no broader facts. And when you look at that last paragraph within this lens, what Stevens actually was saying is that certain NCAA restraints might be okay, including things related to not paying the athletes and things related to amateurism. Now, this was never a blessing of any of these restraints. It was simply Stevens saying that today we are striking down the rules as related to limits on television broadcasts. But we're not saying anything about the rules about no pay of athletes. That's a different case for a different day. Now, if you look at Neil Gorsuch's opinion that came out today, the majority opinion, Gorsuch has a bit of a different writing style than Judge Stevens does.
I think it's very important what you just said. And you're an encyclopedia of information. I know, well, full disclosure, I gave you a DM about 5 minutes beforehand and you're ready to go. So I'm sure you're citing these cases from memory, which is super impressive. The part that I don't want people to lose sight on, that Stevens note that you mentioned, and you were kind of paraphrasing, but that certain NCAA restraints may be okay. So the NCAA has held kind of tight to that language in any number of decisions over the past couple of years, be it O'Bannon and obviously in Alston, and they keep holding and they keep citing to that language and saying, hey, some things might be okay. Even though we lost this case, some things might be okay. Now, I wanted to tee you up for Gorsuch's opinion. I guess I'll kind of phrase it to you this way. Do you think between the reading of Gorsuch's opinion and Kavanaugh's opinion, they're kind of closing that? Or do you think they're not touching it at all? Closing that, hey, some things that the NCAA may do may be okay under the law. Some certain NCAA restraints may be okay. Or are they, you know, closing that loophole and trying to say, hey, there is no antitrust exemption coming for the NCAA, aka they're not above the law?
Gorsuch's opinion and Kavanaugh's opinion are different in tone. Gorsuch's opinion seems to do the same thing that Stevens' opinion did, but he writes it differently. He writes it earlier up, and it writes in a way that might be less subject to future confusion, which is simply saying there are a very narrow range of issues that we're allowed to look at here. We can't go beyond what the parties asked us to do. So in essence, the majority, the 8 of the 9 justices who signed on to Gorsuch's opinion, are saying, beyond these facts, we can't tell you. We can't tell you if it's legal or illegal beyond these facts because we haven't tried these cases. Now, if you read the dicta that comes throughout the majority opinion, I think it's clear that there are certain things that might be close to this or a little bit broader to this that would be found on the wrong side as well, especially if lower courts found it that way, that would be upheld. But it's a very narrow reading. Not saying that what's broader than this would be allowed, not saying what's broader than this would not be allowed, but we only have one crumb of the entire cake in front of us, and we're telling you that this crumb is a violation of antitrust law. You could draw your own conclusions about what's around it. Kavanaugh's concurrence is so interesting to me. Now, Kavanaugh's concurrence almost perfectly tracks my 2013 law review article, A Short Treatise on Amateurism and Antitrust Law.
It's almost as if he read it before writing this decision.
You know, I don't want to say, and I don't want to presume that any Supreme Court justice has read my article. I will tell you with near certainty that if he didn't read it, and Justice Kavanaugh is a very busy person, I'm certain at a minimum the clerks read it.
I'm with you. I'm going to go as far as say that he read it, but that's just me. But go ahead.
And he's completely on board with my whole line of legal writing from that point in time to right today, which is said that it's not just the outer fringes of the NCAA's rules that are on the wrong side. It could be the whole shebang. And Kavanaugh went ahead to give examples in dicta, in essence, as a foreboding to the NCAA, that if the NCAA is going to try to do the same thing with this opinion that they did in Board of Regents in 1984 and pretend that all because the opinion only talked about a crumb, now it makes the rest of the cake okay, be forewarned. Even though the other 8 justices won't say yes or no, I am stepping right in here and telling you that at least some of the other stuff is on the wrong side. And there will need to be substantial changes made by the NCAA to avoid future antitrust liability. Now, keep in mind, the other 8 justices didn't disagree with Kavanaugh. They just chose not to go that far. And I think the Kavanaugh opinion is going to be critically important. And it's going to be critically important because, you know, the one thing I could tell about Kavanaugh's jurisprudence between the 2 antitrust cases he's written decisions on, this one and Apple v. Pepper, is that he's a realist. He might not come across as the intellectual that Gorsuch sometimes presents himself as. Gorsuch was a Rhodes Scholar. But there is something in Kavanaugh's antitrust analysis, which is almost for the people, looking at the practical reality of things and calling spades spades. And Kavanaugh goes out here and in essence is putting on the line the fact that if the NCAA is going to try to pretend that the opinion that only addressed one small issue somehow blessed everything else, he's going right on the record with disagreement. And that could hurt the NCAA in trying to make these arguments in the future, not just to courts, but to Congress as well.
That, I don't know if we disagree on this, but I'm just going to read this last. This is the one that seems to be getting a lot of play on social. This is the last couple sentences of Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence. Nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory that their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate. And under ordinary principles of antitrust law, it is not evident why college sports should be any different, period. The NCAA is not above the law. And that's the end of his concurring opinion. So I just want to focus really on the last 2 sentences. And under ordinary principles of antitrust law, it is not evident why college sports should be any different. That's its own sentence, period. The NCAA is not above the law. The way I read that, right, we've had Justice Stevens' opinion in 1984. So, right, it's about 30 years ago. And you now have this language from Kavanaugh, obviously neither of which were binding. Stevens was dicta. This isn't a concurring opinion. But it seems that Kavanaugh here is trying to unwind whatever Stevens said back in 1984. He's saying it is not evident why college sports should be any different. The NCAA is not above the law. Obviously, we're talking about the context of paying college athletes. But the way that Kavanaugh wrote this sentence, and I think, you know, you're a wordsmith, we're both lawyers, we have to pay attention to periods and commas. This sentence stands alone and seems to be, at least to my eyes, a way that Kavanaugh is trying to say, hey, we're closing the loop on a general antitrust exemption. And I'm not just speaking about this in a paying college athletes context. What do you think of that kind of reading of the concurring opinion?
I generally agree. Now, since we're wordsmithing, I'm going to pick on words here because I think the minutiae is interesting. I don't think he is closing a Stevens loophole because I don't think there ever was a Stevens loophole or an antitrust exemption created by Stevens. If there was, this would have been a lot closer of a case. I think Kavanaugh is closing the NCAA's efforts to misconstrue Stevens's language that the Third and Seventh Circuits had made into a loophole that exonerated a wide range of NCAA behavior. And Kavanaugh is not saying everything that the NCAA does is now an antitrust violation. Kavanaugh is saying if the underlying conduct would be a violation of antitrust law, if taken by any other joint venture industry, it would be a violation of antitrust law here too. That the NCAA is not always in violation of antitrust laws. It's not exonerated from antitrust laws, but it has to be treated just like any other joint venture out there, which means, in essence, we land in the same place, that a lot of what the NCAA does very well might be a violation of antitrust law. And this closes the day of the NCAA running circuits like the Third Circuit or the Seventh Circuit and trying to argue we're different. This, in essence, should put the cute little Westlaw red square or red flag on cases like Third Circuit Smith versus NCAA or the Seventh Circuit trilogy from Garbage coming out of the Banks case, which was questionable at the time, Agnew and Depp, which all found in favor of the NCAA because the NCAA was somehow different. That argument should be dead.
I like the red flag. I think a lot of our listeners will understand exactly what that means. And for those that don't, you know, if you look at Board of Regents right now, maybe there's a yellow flag that's sitting up there somewhere, but red flag basically tells you, hey, you can't really rely on this for certain principles. So kind of going a little out of order, but I think it's important. You know, I want to go back. You were the only person, as far as I was aware, that was saying this would be 9-0. And I remember watching the hearing that day. We were live tweeting it. You know, we had an emergency episode before and another one after. And my vibe, just as a betting man, we'll say, everyone was attacking the NCAA. All nine were going after the NCAA. You know, all nine justices were really, you know, hammering, you know, the NCAA's position. So from people that were in the, you know, the SCOTA space, and I'm only really watching it when sports kind of come up there, but people that were veterans of space and listening to oral arguments kind of said, hey, sometimes the justices will hammer a position, but they'll actually end up adopting that position. They just want to shape these arguments and they want to make sure the argument is fully fleshed out and, you know, the lawyers get to hear their arguments. So if you were just kind of coming in new, you would say, hey, it's obvious they're going to be unanimous opinion because all nine were against the NCAA's position. So can you kind of explain why it's not that easy in an overall Supreme Court context to kind of gauge the justice's opinion? And I know you kind of said as a veteran of antitrust law, you could kind of flesh this out from looking at the American Needle opinion. But I think your analysis to get to 9-0, I think was different than everybody else. So I want to give you your platform to dunk on the sports law industry, so we'll say.
Thank you. It's, you know, being 5'7" on a good day, it's nice to be able to dunk on anyone or anything.
Muggsy was dunking on people. Muggsy and maybe some Spud dunks in there. Nate Robinson. There's some love.
Spud and Nate were. I'm not sure if Muggsy dunked.
Muggsy went on Manute Bol's shoulders and he had a dunk. I'm sure.
That's fair. Well, if I were able to get onto George Murison's shoulders, I probably could slam one down too.
I like it.
Bol Bol. If Bol Bol could carry my weight.
His knees might crumble underneath you, but go ahead.
Not a bad shooter, though. To begin, most Supreme Court decisions are not even decided at the oral argument stage. Many times, the judges know how they're going to rule from the briefs. So the first thing I can say is people are making too big of a deal about the oral arguments. And the oral arguments were exactly what they should be. The first half of them were drilling the NCAA. And the second half was pushing back on Alston's lawyers. It seems that most of the people that disagreed with me that it would be 9-0 or even disagreed with me that the NCAA was going to lose were making one of a few different mistakes in their thought process. One is they were spending a lot of time focused on Justice Breyer calling this a tough case. Breyer did say the words, this was a tough case, but I don't think it was ever tough for Breyer for the reasons people thought it was. The challenge of the case was the plaintiffs only asked for a narrow remedy. And the question was really, do we just strike down this narrow restraint and uphold the decision? Or do we go after the whole shebang? At the end of the day, Kavanaugh was the only one who went after the whole shebang. Breyer might have been considering it. So I think a lot of people relied on that. The other problem is many scholars, even those in sports law, analyzed this case strictly within the context of sports jurisprudence. And you could pull out the several other Supreme Court decisions that involve sport and antitrust and the lower court decisions that involve sport and antitrust. The problem is you're really only looking at one piece of the puzzle. I attacked this, even though it was a sports case, not from the sports lens, but from the antitrust lens. And the first thing that stood out to me was the posture of this case was very different from almost every antitrust case today. Almost every other antitrust case has the plaintiffs asking for a restraint to be deemed to be somehow per se illegal without the need to look at analysis. And almost every case has the defendant, even when it's a joint venture, arguing that the court should not rule for the plaintiff without doing all of the economic analysis. And the conservative school of antitrust law, which grew out of Justice Bork and drew very much from Bork's favorite book, Antitrust Paradox, focused on two principles that have become key in antitrust law. First, that we need real economic analysis before we make a decision. And second, that we should not be deciding cases on public policy grounds. We should be looking at real economic effect. So here, when we have NCAA versus Board of Regents, this was not only a straightforward case, I believe, for the left-leaning justices that support enforcement of antitrust law and are opposed to restraints of trade on labor. This was also a very easy case, perhaps even an easier one, for the conservative justices that believe in the law and economics movement that comes out of Justice Bork and practices the view from antitrust paradox. And the reason why this was such a clear case, in my opinion, from the point of any conservative justice, is even though the conservative justices often rule for the defendants, they often do so because they think we need economic analysis and we shouldn't look at social policy issues. And here we have the NCAA as a defendant saying, we don't look at economic analysis, even though it's been done, let's put it away. And they're also saying, and focus on social policy and treat amateurism differently. And in essence, everything the NCAA asked the Supreme Court to do is the antithesis of everything that emerges from the law and economics movement and Bork School of Antitrust.
As we're talking about this opinion on June 21st of 2021, I think a lot has transpired since the case first came to the court, since it went through the district court, went up through the Ninth Circuit. There's a segment of the district court's opinion. Obviously, this is being affirmed now at the Supreme Court level. So, you know, they're affirming, you know, I guess the kind of is the law of the land, right? If they're affirming and they're not overturning certain parts of the decision. Some of the language in the district court opinion essentially said that student athletes have nowhere else to sell their services. Now, that might have been true at the time of the district court's opinion. But as we sit here on June 2021, that question is a little murkier, right? With the G League popping up and obviously being able to pay their athletes six figures. There's the PCL League. We had Andy Schwartz on, you know, talking about that business model. Obviously, the Overtime League is also another model where athletes can get paid $100,000 in high school. So these leagues are sprouting up. Obviously, I'm just talking about basketball, but and then there's still, you know, maybe an important conversation that's happening at the same time that NIL is now popping up. So it doesn't exist yet. It doesn't exist as of June 2021. But in about 10 days, July 1st, there will be a way for athletes to at least sell their name, image, and likeness, maybe not their services. So I want to get your thoughts as to how you think that weighed into the court's analysis, that they're really was at the time of the district court's decision, no other model where you could play as an NCAA age level athlete. Do you think that factored in at all?
I don't know. If we think about antitrust law, for there to be an antitrust violation in conduct that involves a joint venture, the parties that agree to the restraint must have what's known as market power, which is the ability to control a given market. Now, at the time of the 2013 decision, in both football and in men's and women's basketball, it's reasonable to say that the NCAA member schools collectively had 100% market power in a relevant market, which is clearly beyond the threshold of what you would need to show market power. Now, if we look today, it's a bit more interesting, but I'm not sure it changes anything. The first question is, when you brought it up yourself, Dan, is what do we do about football? Because football hasn't changed at all. But even in right. the context of basketball, you would need to define a relevant market first to determine if there is market power control over the market, which is the ability to control options and relative price. And we know that market power doesn't have to be 100%. We never have a numerical threshold anywhere telling us what market power is, what that threshold would be for market power. But we do have a footnote from a learned hand decision at one point that suggests more than one third of a market could constitute market power. And there's a bill, I don't know if it'll be passed before Congress. It's a pretty left-leaning bill that wants to stipulate 33% as the threshold for market power. So that leaves a few questions. First, if you define the relevant market as not the market for playing semi-professional basketball or one level below NBA basketball, if you define the relevant market as being student athlete, which is a term that the NCAA likes to use, well, then the NCAA member schools collectively still have 100% control of that market. None of the other opportunities out there would apply. If we rejected that and said we have to look at the market more closely, then we have to look at carefully and see whether things like playing in Australia or playing in the Andy Schwartz and Ricky Valenti League might be seen as part of the competitor set. And the traditional rule that seems to be used to determine if you're part of the same market from court seems to be interchangeability. But from the DOJ and FTC guidelines, they apply something called the SNP test, the small non-transitory increase in price test. The question of whether the increase in price, which here would be salary, by about 10 to 15% would shift here labor from one marketplace to the other. So the question would have to be, if compensation shifted upward or downwards by 10 to 15%, would it shift people either in or out of college sports to one of these other enterprises? And that's very much an issue of fact, not an issue of law, and probably an issue of fact that we'll see in future antitrust cases involving college sport, but one that I'm not prepared, and I don't think anyone in the world could be prepared to answer definitively, short an economic study.
I'll leave you with this one. You know, we've obviously gotten into a lot, and I want to be mindful of you know, of your time. And I'm sure your phone is blowing up as mine is today. So I guess the big question is, right, where do we go from here? You answered kind of how this is going to maybe impact name, image, and likeness. But, you know, what is this really doing for the NCAA, right? Is this the nail in the coffin, right? Is this just going to lead to maybe some more movement on the NIL front? How does this decision factor into what I'll say is the looming, I guess maybe demise is the right word, but really these walls kind of closing in? How does this decision in isolation factor into that?
It's a great question. The NCAA is currently being challenged, and deservedly so, on three separate fronts: the direct antitrust front, the state law name, image, and likeness front, and then the challenges by Congress, which began with name, image, and likeness, but are looking from a broader spectrum. On the antitrust front, I think there are certain things that are now very well clear would be on the wrong side. And the NCAA is slowly changing them on their own, kicking and crying and moaning and screaming and denying they have to do it, but changing it. So we're seeing things like the Mark Emmert statement today, which we're not going to sanction any athletes that exercise their NIL rights, or the attempt to relax the transfer rules These are not being done out of the goodness of the hearts of college presidents and board of trustees. This is being done because the writing is on the wall that these conduct will actually be antitrust violations. And if the NCAA is wise, instead of trying to challenge the entirety and claim everything they do is legal, their best bet from the antitrust perspective is to focus on one seat and to try to continue to enforce rules about direct payment to college athletes, which they might lose on too, and let everything else go. Same in their arguments to Congress. The biggest mistake the NCAA could make here, if they want to maintain any of their business practices, is kick and fight and scream about the Supreme Court decision, purport the justices don't understand, and purport Congress doesn't understand. For a very long time, the NCAA, through its media arm, has been attempting to gaslight America by denying the reality of their conduct under antitrust law and denying why so many of the behaviors violate traditional interpretation of antitrust. They need to now get together and meet, figure out what kernel is most important to them and focus on that kernel. But even if they get nothing, college sports is not going to disappear. It's already a highly commercial and highly profitable industry. And even with direct pay to college from colleges to athletes, I don't think that changes much. What will change is the distribution. Right now, we have a crazy system in place where, given how restrained the athletes are in compensation, coaches and athletic directors get windfalls. And you have football coaches and basketball coaches making $8 to $10 million per year. Not only much more than the college president, but also far more than football. We're going to see a change in the distribution, but not necessarily in the effectiveness of college sport.
With that said, you've given all of our listeners a fully comprehensive understanding about the decision, where we go. Anything to add before we let you run?
Sure. Not NCAA based, but Dan, it was a pleasure having you as a student 10 years ago. And as much as a pleasure as it was having you in my class 10 years ago, it's so much more of a pleasure to see what you're doing in the field today and see you being a leader yourself in sports law. So it was great being on the show and happy to come back anytime.
That was very kind of you. And you're always welcome back. I give you a big, we'll give you the hockey assist for kickstarting all this fun stuff. Professor Enneman, thank you very much. And I'm sure we'll speak soon.
Take care.
So that was Mark Edelman. I've known him for a while. He is a fantastic sports law professor and just a really good guy. And he's been a mentor to me for a long period of time. So I guess let's break down, Dan, kind of what he said, the big takeaway, right? This is, by any stretch of the imagination, another dagger, we'll say, to the NCAA. And you addressed this in the intro, right? The NCAA thought that it was a good idea to challenge this. They didn't ask. In our old episode, you and I covered this. But they didn't ask the Supreme Court for an antitrust exemption. And even though they didn't ask for it, seemingly Justice Kavanaugh, in his concurring opinion, has closed the door, right, on that potential, right? And he's saying, again, and under ordinary principles of antitrust law, it is not evident why college sports should be any different, period. The NCAA is not above the law. So you ask me, you ask Professor Edelman, and I'm sure yourself, Dan, that seems to be a shot across the bow, right? That the NCAA, we're not going to deal with this anymore. You are not above the law, and we're going to police you as such.
That certainly is a strong statement, even for a concurring opinion, and will be cited, obviously, in probably dozens of briefs filed in NCAA cases, and will follow the NCAA around for quite a long time and be an oft-quoted piece of today's opinion.
So I think the big takeaway, and then I guess, you know, we can keep this our comments relatively short. We have been waiting on the name, image, and likeness level, on the paying college athletes level, for the federal government to weigh in. State legislators, you know, and politicians have been weighing in. The federal, you know, the Senate's holding these hearings. They held one on June 10th. They held the second Senate hearing on paying college athletes at the NCAA level on June 17th. So what we're waiting for is the federal government to release a name, image, and likeness bill on that level. To basically, we'll say, alleviate NCAA and name, image, likeness from having to come out. And it'll really help student-athletes, A, get paid, but B, get some clarity as to who they're supposed to listen to.
I think today's decision is going to be a catalyst. I mean, I don't know if the deadlines are achievable with the current session of Congress, but I think today's decision moves the ball forward and puts the ball back in Congress's court. And I think something is more likely to be done as a result of today's decisive 9-0 ruling.
Yeah, that's my read on it as well. I think catalyst is the right term, because now you have the judicial branch weighing in, right? And you and I have talked about this for probably now almost a year, Dan, that this is a decision, or this is a topic, well, I'm going to call it just hating the NCAA in general, is a bipartisan issue. On the left, on the right, nobody seems to like the NCAA, but now you have the state legislator weighing in, you have the judicial branch weighing in, and what's left here? The last domino is really...
Sports law professors. That's the last domino to fall, and now
we're sports law professors, and we've already fallen.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll hold off calling myself a law. I call myself an adjunct law professor. Definitely a little bit of an easier path into the academy. But no, we're all professors to some degree, and you know, it's we definitely are not shy about weighing in on this topic or any topic. And I hope that we get another juicy case like this at the U.S. Supreme Court, because it's always amazing to me when the Supreme Court see or hears a sports law controversy, because it really exposes the inner workings of the court's process to all of us who ordinarily will focus on issues from the sports side or the sports legal side. And it's always a treat to get a bird's eye view of how the Supreme Court works and to freshen up on how some of the procedures, how the questions work, and just to be part of the oral argument. I didn't see my first Supreme Court oral argument until I was 55 years old. It was Murphy versus NCAA. And I'll never forget that day. So I'd love to hear more. I'd love to have more of these cases. They're really a lot of fun to really take a case all the way to the highest court in the land in an area that we care so much about.
Well, super exciting, Dan. You know, last time the Supreme Court has touched college sports was really 40 years ago in that Board of Regents case. So really exciting. And I'm happy, Dan, we have the show. You know, once a week we touch the biggest sports law issues. But when we have a topic like this, Dan, which just permeates sports, law, and really just culture, we don't need to hit five topics, then we could just hit this one topic. So, Dan, anything else to add before we put this emergency episode in the books?
No, I think that pretty much caps it. Strong episode. You know, I love the emergency podcast, and this one truly was released in real time. I think we're going to be the first, not only first podcast, but probably the first extended long play analysis of the decision. I mean, this will be out within a couple of hours of the court ruling, and hopefully people will give it a listen, and you know, we can really extend our reach of conduct detrimental and maybe give Mark some, you know, great coverage throughout the you know, sports industry and the media industry, because we had it first. And I think this is really a deep dive, and I'm looking forward to getting this out there as quickly as possible.
And if you are a new listener of Conduct Detrimental, make sure you rate, review, subscribe to never miss an episode. We are a once a week show, and always the latest at the sports law intersection. For Dan Wallach, he is always at Wallach Legal, myself, Dan Lust, at Sports Law Lust. The show is at Con Detrimental on Twitter and Instagram. And with that said, we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental. Mm-hmm.